This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. A report out earlier this month showed a 30% increase in overdoses from opioid use around the country, and that's just in the last year. In Wisconsin, the numbers are even more striking. The state led the nation with a 109% increase in overdoses reported by emergency rooms.
The sharp increase around the country does not surprise Sam Quiñones. Quiñones is a journalist who has covered the opioid crisis extensively in the course of reporting for his recent book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Quiñones was in Milwaukee recently to talk about the issue and joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio. He explained how the crisis began.
I think by going back in time a bit, when there was a feeling in America that we did a very poor job of treating pain, which is true, and that in order to more effectively treat pain, we needed to make far greater use of narcotic pain pills. Narcotics derived from the opium poppy, basically. And this was a radical idea because for many years we did not use those pills for much at all. Those drugs were really very sparingly used, very controlled, certainly never sent home with people. But that changed. And beginning, the roots of that are really in the late 80s, but really by the mid-1990s, you began to see a real cultural shift in modern American medicine. And those drugs are the drugs in those pills are related to the heroin. They're chemically very similar, molecularly very similar, similar effects, similar withdrawals if you get addicted to them, et cetera. And so they became this began to create massive prescribing by doctors, overprescribing really is what it amounted to from coast to coast. This new culture kind of took root in modern American medicine. Doctors bought into this idea that they could do this really risk-free without risk of addicting people. And across the country, you began to see doctors throughout the country prescribing more of these pills and more instances, but really a huge quantities as well. And so we created this amazing, huge supply of narcotics in our medicine cabinets, sloshing around America. A big black market broke out in those pills. And then a lot of people did get addicted. You know, there was a risk. Eventually, people who got addicted, a lot of those folks switched to heroin. Now, sometimes they switched to heroin because the doctors stopped prescribing them and got freaked out. Oh, gosh, I don't want this person to go this route. Sometimes people, though, also switch to heroin because it was just easier to find or it was a bigger boost, you know, than they could get from a pharmacy, from a doctor. But whatever the case, you began to see this transition in the early 2000s and really accelerating by 2010, 11, 12 from these pills to heroin. But there was just so many people addicted to these pills. And that was the difference, that there was created this enormous new market, new demand. Supply created demand. And the supply in this case was not from drug traffickers. It was from doctors. And so that is kind of the short version of how we got to where we are in across the country. You see people overdosing from heroin. But if you dig into their stories, you will understand that almost all of them got involved in that because of pain pills first.
You know, the supply and demand. Was it the demand from patients to get more pills or the fact that the doctors had access to greater amounts of this?
I think it was more the latter, but certainly there was a demand from Americans to be fixed quickly. And the pills fit that. We viewed our bodies as cars. Doctors were car mechanics. They were there to fix us, and we weren't really going to be much a part of the solution. You know, we're not going to be accountable for our own wellness, looking out for what we ate, that kind of thing, getting more exercise, that kind of thing. And so there was this demand in a certain sense, but certainly those folks were not demanding to be – they were not addicted already. They just wanted an easy solution to pain. And sometimes there is an easy solution to pain, and sometimes there is not. And we didn't really want to hear that. So really, though, it was doctors catering to that idea, believing that they really didn't have any choice, pressured by a lot of forces, legal, administrative, patient pressures. It was like you go in for a surgery and the pain for that surgery is going to last 2 or 3 days. And you come away with 30 days worth of pills to take home with you. That kind of thing began to happen millions and millions of times a year, every year, all across the country.
So it just squares itself and exacerbates the problem. And it's concerning that 20 years into this epidemic, it's still getting worse. You know, they deem it the quiet epidemic. But with your book, Dreamland, what got you interested in taking a deep dive into the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, specifically?
Really, I got involved in this whole book because I wanted to understand why heroin traffickers from Mexico were doing such big business. So I kind of backed into the story. But it led me eventually backing up. I got to the pills. I started with heroin and went to the pills. Most people understand this story starting with the pills first. But Portsmouth, Ohio was especially important in all this. First of all, I went there because Portsmouth was where the first pill mills emerge. These are pain clinics in name, but really what they are is a place where a doctor is essentially effectively selling prescriptions for pain pills for cash. And then the patient goes and fills those prescriptions at whatever pharmacy he can find. In Portsmouth, there were the first pill mills, and they began there, and they spread after that to these other towns nearby and then other states. And the idea, the business model caught on as one that can make a doctor a lot of money and a lot of cash and keep that waiting room full constantly, right? But Portsmouth was also the place where I began to see that there was a deeper story here too. There was a story of a community destroyed and that this drug problem had a lot to do with the destruction of community and our own isolation as a result, and that that left us vulnerable. And Portsmouth had this magnificent – it had steel mills. It had a thriving Main Street. It had a population of 50,000. It also had this beautiful, glorious, enormous swimming pool where everybody saw each other. Everybody kind of grew up. It was the town plaza almost. And then the steel mill leaves. The other factories leave. Main Street really is a hollow shell. Half the population leaves. And in 1993, they have to knock this pool down. The name of this pool is Dreamland, which is what I use for the title of the book. And Dreamland, the destruction of Dreamland is almost like a turning point for this town. It leaves it extraordinarily exposed. Of course, so did the departure of all these jobs and locally owned businesses and so on. But the town is therefore vulnerable to having had community destroyed, having isolation kind of creep in. More and more people are gone, so the houses are abandoned. Those who remain behind kind of feel like they're all alone in the world. They don't dare go outside. And the pool is gone. There's no place to see each other. Walmart becomes the place where you see your neighbors, really. No place else. It replaces Dreamland. And it became kind of almost a metaphor for what we have done in America to destroy community, to make ourselves more isolated, to the ignoring, the neglect, the destruction of things that bring us together. And so that's really how I came to view it. I didn't view the town as essential in that way until I was midway through the story. But, you know, the beauty of journalism is you leave yourself wide open to let facts take you in a direction you never imagined, never knew existed. And that's one of the beauties of the job, I think. And that's kind of what happened to me with the book.
Being a journalist, you've covered a multitude of things. But how has this subject gripped you in a different way? Do you feel that it's one of your most important topics that you've taken on?
I do. And I think it's because it came to be a bigger story than I thought it was going to be. I thought I was going to write a story about drug trafficking and business and that kind of stuff. It was about that, for sure. But it was also about much larger issues, again, about who we are as Americans, what we'd become as a country. It became a real idea of how isolated we had become. And then I began to realize all the different ways in which we're isolated. You go up and down these suburban neighborhoods, nobody's on the street. Kids don't even know how to be public, how to play in public, view it as a punishment to get outside the house, to get away from their screens, you know. And we are so afraid of pain. At the same time, this fear of pain led us to this fear of the outdoors. And to me, it felt like there was a much bigger issues here than simply what I had embarked on initially. And that was also some of the beauty of it. I really love journalism because if you leave your mind open, it will take you new places. And that's why I got into it.
A recent report from the CDC notes that addiction and overdose is such a massive problem here in the Midwest. And in Wisconsin alone, we had 109% increase in the past year.
Right, I saw that.
And you're in town to speak here in Milwaukee. What have you observed either in Milwaukee specifically, or what makes the Midwest such a hotspot for addiction?
I think it's, the Midwest is one place where you have one thing that is happening across the country, which is essentially a cultural isolation that we find in all neighborhoods. You know, people just kind of fading into their houses and not being outside and really not knowing anybody around. That's happening all over the country. That's not just here. But the Midwest has also been hammered by job decline. Those factories, those jobs that gave people worth, that gave people fulfillment, that gave communities their center, has been taken away in many, many parts of the Midwest. And I think that may be another reason why you're seeing the Midwest as this major center for this problem. But you're right. Wisconsin, surprised to see that story about a week ago come out, and Wisconsin had seen the largest increase and from 2016 to 17 of any state. But it just shows you really that this is kind of all over the country. It is bad in the Midwest, but you know, it's pretty bad up in New England too, and it's pretty bad in the South too. It's not like there's just one area suffering from this.
What is Dreamland doing to turn around this problem, and what can cities like Milwaukee or other ones in Wisconsin follow by their example?
Well, I leave it to others to assess that. I do know from personal experience that this epidemic was one way before the book came out, and it was another way after the book came out. Before the book came out, it was very hidden. People were very embarrassed to talk about it, how their kids or their spouses or their brothers, whatever, got addicted. It was something that was kind of kept in the shadows, and people made sure that the obituaries were fabrications. You know, you just never saw a confronting of the issue. That's why I thought when the book came out that it would just basically fade away, because I could see it was nationwide a problem. But I could also see that people did not want to talk about it. But then the book comes out, and I would say, I'm not sure other people can assess the role the book played in this, but after the book came out, there was definitely a different way of viewing this problem and more public. People gained maybe courage. They were just exhausted from being alone and all, hiding the truth. And you began to see obituaries telling the truth, no longer fabrications, you know. And then urging parents to beware of addiction among their kids or their spouses or what have you. There was a whole other level and growing increasingly since then of awareness and willingness to confront the problem.
You mentioned that people are now discussing addiction, opioid problems, overdoses are recognized. But do you think that just needs to increase more on the community level? Recently, the Trump administration declared a public health emergency, but that stopped short of declaring it a national emergency, which in turn changes the funding of what can change and what can happen. So do you think that the change and knowing the signs of addiction and discussing it with people so that it's not a quiet epidemic anymore, do you think it needs to change at that community level?
Sure, of course, and that's really where it all has to start. It doesn't start anywhere, doesn't really have an effect otherwise if it starts anywhere else. And you see it emerging from the grassroots, people losing that fear. And when that happens, they see their city councilman at the grocery store. They see their state legislator in church. All of a sudden, they begin to talk about this, and those politicians begin to see that this is now an important issue. For a long time, politicians were largely silent because most politicians simply follow the squeaky wheel theory. You know, whatever is most vocal was going to get my attention, and this was a very silent problem. And so, as that begins to change, it changes at the community level, and I really believe it's at the community level where you find the solutions. And it's when you see these county groups now forming all across the country. I think it's very exciting to watch, very exhilarating to see that these groups coming together, they begin to start leveraging all that energy, all those talents that are in that group. And little by little, they begin to formulate some kind of game plan. It's messy. Doesn't always work. Some things don't work, of course. And almost always it requires small solutions, plural. It's a lot of little things, a symphony, I like to call it, a symphony of solutions. That's my best hunch, let's put it that way, of how we find our way forward on this. But it really starts at the community level. And it was precisely at the community level in most places in America where you just were hearing deafening silence for really, really years, maybe like decades, actually.
So what role can the federal government play to help this?
Oh, I think a couple of things. I do believe that the federal government has a facilitating role, not the instigating role, the facilitating role. One thing I think is a lot more politicians from the federal level need to visit the local level and give people props, give people encouragement. Hey, this is great what you guys are doing here. Hey, talk to the media. Do you see what they're doing in County X? That kind of thing helps. It really does, I think. But also, it's to bring funding, but funding with a long-term vision. Because if it's just 1 year, 2 years, well, you know, that's not going to work. I don't believe that will work. I think what we need is a kind of a long-term vision. I was testifying in the Senate, believe it or not, a very weird, surreal experience. And I told them I think they needed to view this as an opportunity. There's a catastrophe nationally, but you could use it as an opportunity. Like the Marshall Plan was for Europe. We invested in money in Europe for their recovery. It was a win-win all the way around. It stopped the communist expansion and created these new trading partners, new friends. It was magnificent. I think we need to view this as an opportunity, a chance for American recovery, a Marshall Plan for American recovery. So I think that approach from the federal government will aid and encourage all these folks at the local level who are already, without any encouragement from the feds, are already working pretty hard at this. And this is a great opportunity to defeat this penetrating, crippling isolation that has been so much a part of our culture. These are drugs that thrive on isolation, as they did in Portsmouth, as they did when they destroyed Dreamland. These are drugs that create more isolation. People get addicted to these drugs, usually seal themselves off from the world. And so therefore, it stands to reason, my hunch is, that the best way to attack a problem that thrives on isolation and creates more isolation is through community.
Well, Sam Quiñones, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sam Quiñones is a former reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of the recent book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He was in Milwaukee to talk about the subject at the Milwaukee Rotary Club, and he spoke with Audrey Nowakowski then.